become increasingly hard to watch in recent days. What is going on? Where is God in all of this? Man's inhumanity to man is nothing new. We've only read in the Old Testament the attempt to wipe out all the Hebrews. Since sin came into the world, mankind has repeatedly shown just how evil it can be. Any list of examples of persecution by one ethnic or religious group on another, we could just go on and on. According to Open Doors UK, a Christian ministry organisation, a missionary organisation, 100 million Christians in the world today face persecution. And the International Society for Human Rights states that 80% of all acts of persecution are directed at people of the Christian faith. Nor do I want to forget that it's not just Christians who have been and who are being persecuted. We could go on and on. Where is God in all of this? Well, if any book of the Old Testament can claim to be a key text, then Exodus has a good case. In the book of Exodus are the accounts of the rescue of God's people from Egypt, the wilderness years, the covenant, the entry into the promised land. The God of Exodus is a God who controlled history. A holy God, a God who remembered, a God who acted in salvation. The God of Exodus is a living God who does act. He's a God who acts in judgment, a God who is angry when people disobey him. But he's a God whose anger can be averted if there is repentance. The God of Exodus is a God who speaks, and a God who is with his people. So it is strange that in this passage, God is not mentioned until verse 17. Where is God? When his people were living under threat, where is God? Well, the answer, he was there and he is here. You may remember the story of Joseph sold into slavery by his brothers who rose to become the ruler. And he accepted his family when they came begging for help when famine struck the land. They settled in Egypt and they multiplied. Joseph and his brothers died, so that generation had passed. But their descendants were numerous. The original 70 members of the family filled the land of Egypt. Then along came a new king, a new dynasty. They didn't remember Joseph and how he saved Egypt from famine. The new king is worried. These Israelites have become far too numerous. And in his eyes, they were becoming a security threat. Let's work them to death. Now, forced labor was very common in those days. Without it, the pyramids wouldn't have been built. But this slave labor didn't have the desired effect, as the Israelites continued to increase in number. Exactly the opposite of what Pharaoh wanted to happen. So his treatment of the Israelites escalates from enslavement to ethnic cleansing. Where is God? God isn't mentioned. But the fact that the Israelites multiplied fulfilled God's repeated promises to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that their descendants would be too numerous to count. God had told Abraham that his descendants would be enslaved and mistreated. The more Pharaoh oppressed the Israelites, the more God multiplied them. No ruler, no army, no one can destroy what God has chosen to preserve. History shows us that when evil rulers try to persecute God's people, the people emerge stronger. God is not mentioned, but he is there and he is here. Secondly, God works through very ordinary people. It's ordinary people, you and me type people, who deal with these very difficult and challenging circumstances. First up, the midwives. Forced labour did not limit the Israelites, so Pharaoh ordered all the boys to be killed at birth. And he attempted to do this working through the midwives. It is here in verse 17 that God is mentioned for the first time. The midwives feared God and didn't do as Pharaoh asked them to. Instead, they allowed the boys to live. They obeyed God, and God rewarded them. Well, the infanticide may have slowed down, but it doesn't work. And Pharaoh orders that all Egyptian people throw baby Hebrew boys into the Nile. Mass murder continued. And this had very ominous overtones, because God's promise to Abraham that the world would know God through his descendants would not be fulfilled. First, ordinary people, the midwives, clever and brave. Pharaoh was an absolute monarch. He was considered to be the incarnation of the Egyptian god Ra. His word was law. To defy him put your life at risk. The second ordinary person is the mother. She's desperate to save her son, and she acts out of love. The baby boy born in Exodus chapter 2 verse 1 is no ordinary child. We're not told about his parents at this stage. And as the story unfolds, it becomes clear that he has an older brother and a sister. The mother is desperate. So she devises a plan which on the face of it looks doomed to failure. Divine intervention was needed. According to Hebrews, the child's mother had faith in God and in God's power. But she didn't just sit back and do nothing. To take practical action doesn't mean we've stopped trusting God. Action and trust go hand in hand. Hatred and fear motivate Pharaoh. He tries to draw a line, the them and us line. His attitude is one of hatred, oppression, as he attempts to wipe out a race. In the later chapters of Exodus, God does take direct action against Israel's opponents. But in this passage, he's more subtle and indirect. It doesn't mean he's not there. He he is there and he works through ordinary people. Thirdly, God is also subtle and indirect. The mother is resourceful. She keeps her baby hidden for 3 months. I don't quite know how she manages to do that. She decides she's going to act to save him. She got a papyrus basket, we all know the story, Moses and the bulrushes, covered it with tar and pitch. Incidentally, the word used to describe the basket is the Hebrew word for ark. And it's only the second time in the Bible. It's only used twice. Noah's the other one. It's only the second time it is used in the Bible. Because people prepared their own instruments of delivery. She took the child down to the Nile, putting in the reeds. It's ironic, isn't it, that Pharaoh had ordered every Hebrew baby boy to be chucked into the Nile. So in a very ironic way, she's complying with the order. But he has been carefully prepared for survival. Now, I'm not sure I would be so keen, you know, to sort of put the baby in the reeds in the River Nile, because I think it's a very risky thing to do. She was certainly taking a risk. All I could think of was, well, there are crocodiles in the River Nile, swimming up and down, but apparently they do not lurk in the reed beds. Maybe they get stuck or something in the reed beds. So he was putting the reeds. He could have been swept away and drowned. And if you've seen the Disney film, which I have, and I absolutely love it as well, it's another really lovely film, when the baby's swept down the Nile, you know, bouncing along, that's not going to happen because she put him at the water's edge in the reeds. She did not abandon him because she left his sister on the lookout to see what would happen. God works in a very subtle and indirect way when Pharaoh's daughter spots something in the reeds and asks it be brought to her. She sees it as a baby and she feels sorry for him. She must know that is a Hebrew baby. But that doesn't matter. Her instinct is to save him. She wasn't intentionally serving the Hebrew God, but she was all part of the plan. Her humanity recognized a vulnerable child, and she feels moved to save him in direct defiance of her father's orders. His word was law. And then there's young Miriam, who does as she's told by her mum, watches from a distance, and only a child, she intervenes at the right moment with the right words. An Egyptian noblewoman would not be involved in bringing up a small child. So the baby is nursed by its own mother. He would have been brought up a Hebrew and taught all the traditions of that faith. On reaching a certain age, though, she hands him over to Pharaoh's daughter and she names him Moses. So Moses is brought up in two worlds, by his Hebrew mother, so he identifies the Hebrews as his people. But he's adopted by an Egyptian princess. And she brings him up as her son. But, again, the irony of the story is, Moses has now come into the protection of Pharaoh's household. who is actually in the midst of the very person who wants to kill him. Quite a start in life. We leave the story with Moses in Pharaoh's home. Very dangerous situation to be in. But God is at work in subtle ways, in indirect ways, through lots of different people. Three groups, I think, worked by their ingenuity and bravery to save Moses. And finally, I think I really need to try and get across, apart from the fact that God is here, even though he's not mentioned, and it doesn't always feel like it, that God uses ordinary people, but he also uses our mixed motives. The midwives acted out of fear of the Lord. Fear means reverence, trust, obedience. Their reverence for God gave them a reverence for life. Reverence for God gave them a reverence for life. Moses' mother and sister act out of love. They use their ingenuity and act out of love. The Egyptian princess has no reason to want to save a Hebrew baby, but she saw he was vulnerable and she had compassion, which led her to save him. Fear of the Lord, love for a son, and compassion all stand in defiance of the cruelty and hatred of Pharaoh. They may not have known it, and certainly the Egyptian princess would not have acknowledged it, but they were all part of God's plan. God was at work through these women. I had to mention they were all women, but then turn up later. God had not been obvious, but he was there. He was working through these very different women who acted for a variety of motives. God may not be obvious, but he is here, working in our very ordinary lives, using our mixed motives to further his kingdom. Tolkien's book, The Hobbit, the wizard Gandalf explains why he has selected a small hobbit to accompany the dwarves to fight the enemy. Gandalf says this: Sauron believes it is only great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I found it is the small, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay. Small acts of kindness and love. We live in dark times, but we are to be the light in the darkness. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. We know the end of the story, but at the end of our reading, Moses is in a very difficult position. If this young man is to accomplish anything, God is going to act again. So just as often in our own lives, we don't know how God is at work. Our initial hopes and plans might disappear, and yet it's only as we trust God and remain faithful to him that we come to understand that God is not yet finished. Something that may appear to be so ordinary and common. I mean, they feel so ordinary and common. God, out of his love and mercy, will turn into something wonderful. Shall we pray? When oppression, cruelty and fear are all that is known, and suffering the daily experience, when famine, hunger and thirst greet every morning, denying basic sustenance, it is easy to say, there is no God, to turn aside, to label you an irrelevance, you who are living water, bread of life, the one who offers deliverance, who suffered, died, and rose, bringing hope. Bringing hope that there is more to life than this. Bless all those who in despair and dark places look to you for assurance. Bring comfort and peace to those who have lost all hope of security and calm. For you are Almighty, the Prince of Peace, the light of the world that the darkness cannot overcome.